It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. This is a story I tell about once every 2 years. So some of you may have heard it before. I really just tell it for the grown-ups. They like it. And it's a true story. It's a story that happened now, I just realized, over 50 years ago, when I was a little older than you are. I was about 13 at the time. And I lived in a small town in Iowa. And my brother and I had horses. My brother had a white horse who was very frisky and mean, at least to me, and whose name was Spooky. And I had a brown, completely mellow, laid-back, cool horse named Louie. And we would ride our horses all over the countryside. We'd come home from school and put saddles on the horses or ride bareback and just ride and ride and ride. Sometimes on the weekends, we would take the horses and take a rifle with a saddle holster and go camping for 2 days, set up a place to camp, build a little corral for the horses, shoot a squirrel or two for dinner, build a fire, and eat a dinner of overcooked squirrel and stream water, pretending that we were the greatest cowboys in the world. It was a magical world. We also used to like to feed the horses candy, because horses, like dogs and lots of kind of animals, and us, like sweet things. But the vet told us one day we needed to stop feeding sugar cubes to the horses because it would rot their teeth, just like it rots ours. So we were told we couldn't feed sugar cubes to our horses anymore, even though they liked them. We could feed them apples and carrots, and that was all right, but it just didn't have the pizzazz of feeding them sugar cubes, because they would really rush for the sugar like we do. So one of the things my brother and I wondered about in our pre-scientific way was what else there might be that was sweet besides sugar cubes. And I'm not sure how we stumbled on this. I think it was one morning at breakfast when my brother didn't want to drink his grape juice, and my mother asked him why, and he said, "It's too sweet." And our eyes lit up. We thought, grape juice is sweet. So after our mother left, we took the grape juice outside and we poured it in the dog bowl. And then we brought the horses over to it. And the horses loved the grape juice. Now that doesn't sound like much, but what we loved about the horses loving grape juice is that after they'd put their noses in the bowl to drink grape juice, their noses were purple, and their tongues were purple. And we thought that was really cool, especially my brother, whose horse was white with a purple nose and a purple tongue. So we would do this often when our mother was away. And for another reason that we can't explain and would not want to be held accountable to explain, we left the dog bowls up on the back porch, the little wooden rickety back porch, and would bring the horses up on the porch to drink grape juice out of the dog bowl. So one day, when the horses were up drinking their grape juice out of the dog bowl, and they'd finished and had been all purpled up, Spooky went down the stairs first, but he broke the stairs. And Louie, being a very smart horse, wouldn't go down off the porch because there were no stairs left. So we had a problem. I guess I had a problem. And my problem was how to get a horse off the back porch before my mother got home. Now I had two friends with me helping, and my brother was there, and I finally said, "I've solved this. We'll just take the horse through the house." You've got to admit it's logical. My brother immediately jumped on his horse and rode far away. I didn't see him for hours. My friends giggled like, "You're not really serious." But of course I was serious, because we have to get the horse off the porch, and the horse can't come down off the porch because there are no steps. But if we take him through the house, we can take him out the front door, and there's a new porch with concrete steps. It was very logical. And I thought about this and the problems there might be in bringing a horse in the house. And so I got a bucket, metal bucket, and I gave it to the younger of my two friends, Jimmy. I told Joey he could hold the halter and lead the horse through the house, sort of. I'd move things, chairs, tables, lamps. But Jimmy's job was to walk behind the horse carrying the bucket. Now, I must tell you, Jimmy didn't like this job. He wanted a vote, but it was done. So we went into the kitchen and led the horse around the table and through the door and in through the dining room, and everyone is in their place, and Jimmy is whining all the way through the house. And we got to the living room and had forgotten that the television set had been left on, so the TV is on. And when the horse got to the middle of the living room, he stopped. And his ears went up, and he turned, and he watched the television. And I'm thinking, this horse is thinking, we don't have one of these out in the barn. They got stuff up here in the big house we don't see out there. I like this. So he was standing absolutely, he didn't want to move anywhere, ears up, absolutely full of attention, watching the television. And I thought, well, this is a good picture. So I went to get a camera with a flash bulb. We used to use flash bulbs. They were kind of loud and very bright. Sometimes they even exploded. And I came back and I told the boys, just cool it, and I took the picture very quickly, and then several bad things all happened. One thing I noticed was that Jimmy had left his post. He wasn't standing around at the back of the horse with his bucket the way he was supposed to. This had all been worked out. He was standing around the front of the horse, and his bucket was on the floor by the horse's front legs. Now, this shows that he knows absolutely nothing about how horses are put together or what the bucket was for. And the second thing that happened that was bad was that the flash scared the horse. And he pooped on the rug. Right where the bucket would have been. Well, we got the horse out of the house. Jimmy and Joey ran as fast as they could to go home. I took Louie back to the barn, the one without the television. And I came back in and had a mess to clean up. So I went under the kitchen sink, where magical stuff is kept, and I found a bottle. I don't even think they make this anymore. Found a bottle called Glamourine Rug Cleaner. And I thought, that's just what I need, because the rug is not clean. So I cleaned up the rug, and then I got Glamourine Rug Cleaner, and using the bucket that Jimmy didn't use, filled it with water and Glamourine Rug Cleaner and scrubbed the rug, and sure enough, got it all the stain out, got it completely clean, but now it had a wet spot about 3 feet in diameter. So I took a throw rug from the other side of the room and just covered the wet spot, and I thought, no one will notice this. And sure enough, I got away with this. Days went by, weeks went by, it was wonderful. and I knew that I had committed pretty near the crime of the century and got off scot-free. And then one day, I came home, and as I entered the front door, I heard my mother calling in that mother voice. You know the mother voice? Yeah. And she called my name, and she said, "Come in here!" And I thought, oh, that's that voice that says something's wrong, and it could involve me. And I walked into the kitchen, and she was sitting at the table looking fairly angry. And she said, "What do you mean bringing that horse in the house?" Now, I thought about this. My brother wouldn't tell. My friends wouldn't tell. They'd never ride the horse again. Louie isn't talking. She can't know. So I said, "What horse?" And my mother said, "I just got the pictures back from Rexall Drugstore." I said, "Oh, that horse." We have, let's see, would you, Claire, would you go over to him and get a picture he wants to give you to bring back here? Here. Here, I'll just stand. Now, this is actually one of those stories that I think no one would believe without the photo. But the whole story is right there in the picture. On the far right, you can see the thin black line of the television set that the horse is watching. If you look in front of his front legs, you see that silver bucket that has no business being there. And Jimmy standing behind it about 8 feet in front of where he should have been standing. And Louie just looking cool and enjoying television. After we talked about this in the kitchen, it seemed to me that while my mother was upset, she hadn't even noticed the throw rug that had been moved. And I moved it back 4 days later when the rug dried out. And then I noticed that she was almost laughing. And every kid knows how to play with that when you think you've got your parents going. And I said, "What's the matter, Mom?" And she said, "This is so ridiculous." She said, "I have no idea what to say." She said, "I feel like an idiot telling you not to bring the horse in the house again." And that ended the story of the horse in the house. I carried this picture in my billfold for almost 20 years. And one day when I spent the night at my brother's family's, he picked my pocket in the night and stole the picture and sent it off to have it copied and gave me the big print of it for Christmas that I've had. So this was a picture taken in the summer of 1955. And that's the end of the story about the horse in the house. In the center of our service and the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Let us join in an attitude of prayer. There are little sparks of life around that we often miss. A special person, a twinkle in the eye of someone who just seems so very real to us. Little lights seem scattered here and there in our lives. People, places, even things that can awaken our own spirit in ways large and small, but in ways we wish for. So often when life seems dull, or we seem to be in a rut, we've lost sight of those sparks or lost touch with them. spontaneous things, unplanned fun, or contact with those people who seem to have such a young spirit, no matter how old they are. These things help. There's an old mystical story that says all these sparks of life are parts of God, and that our task is to find them, draw them to our lives, and use them to transform ourselves and our world back into an image of God. Drawing the world back into an image of God sounds like a task far beyond anything we can do. But we do recognize those moments, those people and places that make us feel more alive, that seem to make life offer more options, that open us up. Let us start there, attending to the sources of inspiration that make us feel more alive, more thankful, more joyful. Let us claim those sources and the little sparks of life they offer, even if they offer them only to us. The task of reconstituting the world is too big to imagine. Let us bring it down to a level we can see and feel, reconstituting one spirit at a time, one life at a time, one relationship at a time, to make them show forth more light, more love, and more joy. It's a start. It's a good start. Amen. There's a wonderful story from medieval Jewish mysticism about how in the beginning God existed as a vast, infinite, undifferentiated light, nothing but light. But God apparently grew bored, and he wanted to see what he looked like, which you can't do if everything is undifferentiated. So in this myth, he created all of the world, all of the universe, as a reflection of himself, so that God could see what God looks like, which means the world is the body of God, taken as a whole. But then in the story, God withdrew his light from the world and has seemed absent ever since. But he wasn't completely gone. The light, it said, was scattered into billions and billions and billions of sparks. And these sparks, each one of them part of God, part of the creative powers of life and love and joy and the universe, are scattered everywhere. We may not run across a lot of them in a life, but when we do, it's a sacred thing, and there's a task waiting for us there. Because it's our task to be able to see and find these sparks where life can enter, and to bring them to us, and to raise them up and spiritualize them, and help incorporate them into our life. And that's our job in helping to reconstitute the world. So the myth says that if everyone were to do this, you would once again have a world put together with all the sparks drawn in together, and the world would once again reflect the image of God. It's a lovely story about peace and justice, and also offering some down-to-earth things that we can look for, so that our task in life is to cherish those sparks that it's our good fortune to find. There are a lot of ways to describe those sparks, and that's not the only word that's been used for them. But when you're around one, you generally notice it. One of the problems with this task, though, seems to be that we have to be able to recognize them when we're around them. And mostly we seem to notice these sparks when they're gone, more than when they're around. This may have something to do with growing up. I'd hate to think so, since we all have to do that, growing up. But some of the evidence makes it look like it has a lot to do with growing up. And I was reminded of two poems. One I'll read you just a few lines from, but the other one is too fun not to read the whole thing. The one I'll read you just a few lines from was written about 150 years ago by Thomas Hood. And it's a long, nostalgic poem of a man wishing for a childhood, or wishing for the magic of a childhood, or wishing for something that has seemed lost to him for a long time. And the last lines of his poem that I've always loved, he says, I remember the fir trees dark and high. I used to think their slender tops were close against the sky. It was a childish ignorance. But now 'tis little joy to know I'm farther off from heaven than when I was a boy. It's lovely. Here's an older man missing and remembering something. When we miss that, if we miss that spark, you can say it certainly has produced a lot of nice poems, like that one. It's produced some great tragedies, dramas, sad stories, and other things. Sometimes it even produces funny poems. When the kid that's looking for the spark seems to be present in writing the poem, those are a lot more fun. And I found one of those. This one's famous. I think that there's some kind of a requirement in America that every woman knows this poem, but maybe not. It's at least been a favorite of women who think that one day they might become old and want to warn people about what might happen when that day comes. You've probably all heard it. It was written in 1961 by an English woman named Jenny Joseph, and her original title for it was simply Warning. But this has so many wicked little spirits hiding behind the words, and so many threats of tricksters and elves and goblins jumping out, it's too much fun not to read. Warning. When I'm an old woman, I shall wear purple with a red hat that doesn't go and doesn't suit me. And I shall spend my pension on brandy and summer gloves and satin candles and say we've no money for butter. I shall sit down on the pavement when I'm tired and gobble up samples in shops and press alarm bells. And I'll run my stick along the public railings and make up for the sobriety of my youth. I shall go out in my slippers in the rain and pick the flowers in other people's gardens and learn to spit. You can wear terrible shirts and grow more fat and eat 3 pounds of sausages at a go, or only bread and pickles for a week. And you can hoard pens and pencils and beer nuts and things in boxes. But now, we must have clothes that keep us dry and pay our rent, not swear in the street, and set a good example for the children. We must have friends to dinner and read the papers. But maybe I ought to practice a little now, so people who know me are not too shocked and surprised when suddenly I am old and start to wear purple. Each of these goofy things has a kind of an irrepressible, bold spirit coming through all these images of hers, learning to spit. Sometimes it seems that we lose the ability to see these sparks or these spirits, and that it has something to do with growing up. Thomas Hood's poem longs for his first childhood. Jenny Joseph's poem longs for her second childhood. And that's a big part of why it's so much fun seeing the children come up here for the stories. There's something irrepressible that comes up here with children. You have no idea what they're going to say or do. And as storytellers up here know who have tried to let the children into the story, you can lose control immediately. and never get it back. They bring a sense of wonder with them and a sense that the polite rules and boundaries that we seem so obsessed with aren't very real after all. That's what these spirits do. They just seem to do so easily what grown-ups sometimes have trouble doing at all. During my very first year in the ministry, in 1986, I witnessed such a scene, almost a classic scene, and one I will never forget. It was after the third sermon I'd preached there, so it was late September of 1986. I'd written a series of children's stories for the first 3 weeks so we could bring the children up on the stage, and that had been a change in the church's culture. And the stories were kind of like a serial, and they were really a very simple story. Not a great one, but a simple one. It was a story about a bush that became unhappy just being a bush because all those darn birds took it for granted, and it didn't have a starring role like the trees did. And the more unhappy it got, and the angrier it got at just having to be a bush, the more its roots came out of the ground, until at last they pulled out, the wind blew, and it became a tumbleweed. Now it blew around and around and around, and that was fine, but it never stopped. It had no home, and it began feeling lonely. When the wind stopped for a while, the little tumbleweed found itself resting not too far from a lovely little river in a beautiful meadow. It was grateful for the rest and to be in such a pretty place, and soon, without even being aware of it, it put down roots, and again it became a bush. Now when birds came to sit in its branches, it was thankful for the company. It came to love the place and all the other creatures in its world, and as that happened, the bush grew and grew and grew and finally became a very, very big tree. The end. Not a great story, a simple story. I wasn't prepared for what happened after the service. In the foyer, a church member who was a physics professor came up to me. I wish this had been filmed. Raging mad. He was actually red in the face as he accused me of having done a ridiculous and shameful thing. My crime was that I had told the children a story that could not be scientifically true. I could hardly believe it. It was ridiculous, he yelled, to say that a tumbleweed could again put down roots and become a bush. Though he didn't know the scientific names of the plants involved, he was quite sure it couldn't happen. And then, as though that weren't bad enough, I had gone to absolutely stupid extremes by telling the children that the bush could become a tree. It's ridiculous, he said, getting pretty worked up. Then he shook his finger at me, and he said, "Do you actually believe that a bush can become a tree?" I said, "Yes." Now he turned purple. He was almost shouting as he said, "Well, I would like to know how in hell a bush can become a tree." That's when the 6-year-old boy, who had been standing behind me, waiting for his turn, finally had all he could take. He stepped forward, looked up at the physicist, and he said, "It's easy, mister. It just has to learn how to love." You hear something like this, and it can feel like Peter Pan felt in never wanting to grow up because you'll lose the magic. And that growing up means losing the ability to understand even the simplest of stories. My God, what a price to pay. The little boy had been waiting to tell me how much he had liked those three stories, and that he would never forget them, and that he had written them down and kept them in his room. By now he's old enough to know that they weren't very great stories. But at the time, they held a spark for him. The man was in his 50s, had a PhD in physics from a good university, yet actually seemed to think that the story had been about a bush. If we lose the ability to see even the simplest magic when we grow up, why do it? How? The kid knew the story wasn't about a bush. He knew it was about him and life. Why grow up? But we do. We have to grow up. Eventually, our parents want us to move out and get a job. And to get a job, you usually have to grow up. You know, it's one thing to have your kid bring a horse in the house once. But if every roll of film you got developed had a picture of your child with another large, heavy animal standing in your living room, you'd be looking for a therapist. A spark is all right. A fire is something quite different. I don't know what quite happens to us when we grow up, but something does seem to change, and it was that change that Peter Pan was so afraid of. I remember stories of the old hippies of the 60s and 70s, some of them sitting here, who had tuned in, turned on, and dropped out, and then reading articles a decade or two later of how they had grown to become investment bankers and organization men and women, becoming the new incarnation of the very establishment that they'd spent their younger days fighting against. And now they raised their own children and suffered through their teenage rebellions, wondering why they wouldn't grow up. Sometimes it seems that part of growing up is losing touch with that spark, that almost magical and transformative insights of even the simplest fairy tales and stories. Like a story about a beauty that remains asleep until wakened by a loving kiss. About frogs turning into princes in the same way. Or tumbleweeds turning into bushes and turning into trees just because they learned how to love. Those are not stories about sleeping beauties, frogs, or bushes. They're stories about us. But without seeing the sparks in these stories and being open to them, we really are farther off from heaven than when we were young. And the heaven in this story isn't someplace up above the sky. It's that kind of a life where we feel the sacred dimensions, the sparks. We feel that they're right so close to us, we could almost reach out and touch them. That's what we need, and that's what we seem to lose. Now, growing up doesn't have to mean this. You don't have to grow old just because you grow up. And we all know some people with both plenty of years and plenty of sparks. We have some in this church. In fact, they're probably some of our very favorite people. They're some of the vessels carrying those sparks into our lives for us to find and claim and embody in our own sacred task of trying to reconstitute our little part of the world. When I was a graduate student, in a very arid, intellectual, and usually quite impersonal graduate school, a place where you'd think sparks would run from as fast as they could, there were a few of these living sparks around, and I'm struck these years later by how powerful those moments were, and how much they stood out against all the other things that the graduate school was really supposed to be about. My teacher was one of them. He was a man in his 60s who wore beads, had an earring, wore jeans, sometimes sandals, and open collars that had somehow survived from the hippie movement. And he wore shoulder-length hair, except on top where he didn't have much hair at all. He really looked ridiculous standing in a room of people in three-piece suits. He looked like a walking refutation of grown-up seriousness. We became close. I had a lot of dinners with him and his family. And I still remember the odd feeling that one of the greatest living theologians in the world was an oversized elf. And that I thought that the special spirit he brought to the study of theology came from the elf more than from the professor. Now, I had another professor, very different, much more sober and quiet, very, very grown up, John was. During the week, if he wasn't teaching an advanced seminar or discussing the footnotes of footnotes, and he loved to do that, You would find John in the library meticulously digging up even more footnotes. He was really grown up. Ah, but on Sunday night, after the sun went down, some of the students would gather in the lounge for an evening of playing Dungeons and Dragons. And there was John, playing the dungeon master, dressed in a wonderful brownish medieval robe with big hood and a rope belt that his wife had made for him. And I think she sewed a little pink butterfly in the back where he couldn't see it. And he sat there with his eyes twinkling like a six-year-old boy and looking more excitedly alive than I ever saw him at any other time. On Sunday nights, magical, life-giving sparks just flew from John. And I suspect that if someone were to have asked John whether he actually believed in that ridiculous Dungeons and Dragons stuff, he might have said, well, he actually believed that letting ourselves expand in imaginary escapades we'll never be able to encounter in grown-up life might open up whole new, wonderful avenues for our souls to take flight. And he could provide footnotes for that. In religious studies, you often call figures like this trickster figures, and they have them in almost all traditions. These are the figures that don't follow grown-up rules, that bring spontaneity into life, whether you want it or not, usually when you don't. They do unexpected, even rude things. They learn to spit, that sort of thing. Even the more official and restrained parts of the university, however, sometimes welcomed in trickster figures, and it was always a surprise because it was the last place on earth I'd come to expect them. The most memorable came on Christmas Eve one year in the big formal service at Rockefeller Chapel. Here was this cathedral built with the money of John D. Rockefeller. It was a stone building more than 100 feet high inside. It could seat over 2,000 people. It had been modeled on some of the magnificent cathedrals of medieval Europe and had an endowment to pay for staff music forever. But the Sunday services were so dismal that it seldom drew more than 35 people. But on Christmas Eve, it was packed. Organ, huge choir, medium-sized orchestra, priests in formal robes, everybody being very sober and pious and very grown up. Just the sort of place a trickster might need to come. And it did. Unannounced, unexpected, into the middle of this great pomp, they staged a reenactment of the old Bible story of Joseph and Mary looking for a place to stay. And slowly from the end of the long stone aisle all the way to front came this year's Joseph and Mary and a donkey. A real live donkey. The donkey didn't know the story. The donkey didn't care at all for the music or the costumes or much else besides the carrots Joseph would try to slip it unnoticed. The donkey had no costume. No pretense, couldn't have cared less about Christmas, and completely stole the show. Finally, amidst all this pomp, when the donkey entered, finally there was something that was simply real. And then 2,000 people realized, that's what we've been hoping for. Not the pomp. Something real. Bringing the donkey into the temple revealed the temple in the donkey. But if even a little donkey could contain a temple, then surely we could too. That was the Christmas message that year. I have no idea what the speaker said. Just knowing that we too could contain a temple is part of reconstituting the world in the image of God. And sometimes just telling these stories is like bringing a donkey into the temple. I think that's the role that stories, fairy tales, movies, and some fantasy games can play. And it's a role we need if we're going to find some of those sparks. I don't know if Mardi Gras or Burning Man or the others offer more escape than transformation, but anywhere that spirit is present, it can offer transformation, and sometimes will, because it shows that power that represents an unchained life and a beckoning one. I wonder, I won't ask for hands, how many of you have thought some version of when I'm older and no longer afraid of what people might think, I'll wear purple or do something else outrageous. I wonder what those things would be that would let your soul take flight. Do you think it might be wise to practice them a little now so that when you get older and have the nerve to do outrageous things, people won't be surprised? My story about bringing the horse in the house may not be about much more than dealing with a problem you will never, ever have. What to do with a horse that's stuck on your back porch before your mother comes home. That's not a spiritual quest at all. Yet there's something in that goofy story that still has some silly magic to it, a spark to it, even 50 years later, isn't there? Let's not grow up without bringing with us that child's ability to feel pure joy, to expect magic everywhere, and to be able to find it. These sparks can come through so many different doors. They can arrive like a little donkey. They can be like a spark or a lightning flash. Sometimes they come announced by that still small voice that prophets love to write about. And sometimes, you can trust me on this one, they even whinny.